Well, good morning. It's wonderful to see every single one of you. Our topic this morning, the title of this lesson is simply The Vineyard of the Lord. The Vineyard of the Lord. And if I'd have thought, I would have asked Doug to sing that song. And that just now came to my mind. But the Vineyard of the Lord, you know, vineyards were very important in biblical times. And there was even a song written about vineyards during the days of Isaiah. And it's that song that's going to form the foundation for our lesson. It is recorded in the 5th chapter of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 5. And so the first 7 verses really give us the introduction, the background to the song. The rest of the chapter then goes ahead and gives us the reason for why the song is so important and how the people at that time and today need to apply it. First of all, notice verses 1 and 2 of Isaiah chapter 5. Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And so here we have this introduction where the one who made the vineyard describes how everything possible had been done to make sure it would produce the very best possible fruit. But what happened? It only produced wild grapes. And when you go back and look at this word for wild in the Hebrew language, it's not just worthless grapes. They were worthless, but they were offensive, smelled, and some sources even say they were poisonous. So these were really bad grapes. And that's how he starts. Then verses 3 and 4. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? So he says, nothing more could have been done. There was good soil. It had been carefully prepared, you know, all the stones and rocks and weeds taken out of it. It had been the very best stock was used for the grapevines. It had been protected. There was even a wine press made. So everything possible, and this is going to be a very important point, had been done for it. So now notice verses 5 through 7. And now, please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it shall be burned, and break down its wall and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. Now he explains what this is all about. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression. For righteousness, but behold, a cry for help. What do we learn here? Isaiah reveals the identity of the vineyard and the one who planted it. The vineyard is his people, the house of Israel. The one who planted it, took care of it, watched over it, did all of this, of course, was Jehovah God. And so because of everything he had done for it, what did God expect? Good grapes. In other words, his people, ones that listened to his word, produced justice and righteousness, not oppression, not a cry for help. See, he expected love. Received indifference. Expected holiness. Received impurity. See, God had bent over backward for them in every possible way. But now he tells them, those days are over. All right? Those days are over. No more protection, no more help, no more anything. He was going to remove all of his protection, and he was going to lay it to waste. He talks about briars and thorns. No rain is going to come. So the rest of the chapter now, beginning in verse 8, describes several woes that are pronounced upon the wicked among his people. Now, certainly, the primary application was God's people back, 700 plus years before the birth of Christ. But every single one of those woes can be applied to us today. First woe, verses 8 through 10. Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field, till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly, many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. See, he's pronouncing a woe to the greedy. Some in Israel were only concerned about getting more and more stuff. In particular, he talks about land and houses. They were selfish. They were greedy. They never had enough. He says they joined house to house, field to field. See, they just keep getting more and more and more and more. That's all they want. They're never satisfied. So some in Israel, he's pronouncing this woe on because they were greedy, greedy for gain. You know, the wise man Solomon in Proverbs talks about this a great deal. Even in the very first chapter of Proverbs, he talks about greed and wanting more and more. Notice, first of all, Proverbs 1, verse 19. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners. See, greed is self-destructive. And we've seen this in our lifetime with so many people, you know, on the news and so forth. They're so greedy. What do they end up doing? Usually it destroys them in some way. And that's what the wise man Solomon said. In that same chapter, Proverbs 1, still talking about these same type of people, verses 26 and 27 says, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind. When distress and anguish come upon you. And again, we see this so often with people who are never satisfied. They want more and more and more. And in some way or other, it is taken away from them, away from them. So God here in our text talks about 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. Well, an ephah was about 1/10 of a homer. And a homer was about 100 gallons or 10 bushels. So an ephah was about a bushel. So he's saying, you might plant 10 bushels and you're going to receive one bushel. In other words, the crop, the harvest was going to be disastrously low. Disastrously. Why? Because God wasn't doing anything for them. Just like he said in the song about the vineyard. He had done everything for them. In every sense of the word, he had done everything for them. And God said, those days are over. I'm not going to do it anymore. And as a result, the harvest, he says, for the greedy was going to be extremely low. Well, here we come to the next woe, beginning in verse 11, and then he repeats it in verses 22 and 23. Verse 11. This is a rather long one. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, till wine inflames. The harp and the strings, the tambourine and flute and wine are in their feast. But they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. People shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. Then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, in the waste places of the fat ones strangers shall eat. And then he repeats this woe in verse 22. He says, woe to men mighty at drinking wine. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. You know, scripture is filled from beginning to end with warnings about the evil effects of drinking alcohol. I mean, over and over and over again. And how sad it is that it's becoming perfectly acceptable in the religious world, even in the more stricter evangelical world. It's becoming perfectly acceptable. People are simply ignoring places like this. A woe for people who drink intoxicating drink. Woe to them. In Proverbs, again, the wise man, same thing, tells us the same story in the 23rd Proverb, beginning in verse 29. Proverbs 23:29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those are the questions. Here's the answer, verse 30. Those who linger long at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine, do not look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. Your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you'll be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? He tells us, what does alcohol do? Well, one thing it does is it loosens your inhibitions. Makes one irresponsible. People do things when they drink that they would never think of doing when they were sober. He says, when one drinks, what do? They forget God. That's what he says happens. They do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands. People, when they drink, one of the last things they think about, of course, is God and doing what's right and being holy. So, the warning in Isaiah 5, Proverbs 23, and a host of other places. Drinking any type of intoxicating drink, regardless of the amount is not important. Just drinking it. It causes you to lose your senses. You don't think straight. Again, that's why people do so many stupid things when they drink. They say things that they would never say. They go places they would never go. And so he says in verse 13 of our that we read, therefore my people have gone into captivity. They hadn't yet. In the Hebrew language, this would be called a prophetic future. It's so certain that this is going to happen, that they go into captivity, that it is seen as something that's already happened. And what's he said? What does he say? Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. The grave. Sheol is seen like a huge monster with this great big mouth. It's wide open, ready to swallow these evil people. We go ahead a few chapters to Isaiah 14. we read verse 9. Isaiah 14, verse 9, has some similar symbolism. Verse 9 of Isaiah 14. Hell from beneath is excited about you. Again, the grave and Sheol, this land, to meet you at your coming. It stirs up the dead for you, all the chief ones of the earth. It has raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. They all shall speak and say to you, have you also become as weak as we? Have you become like us? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your stringed instruments. The maggot is spread under you, and worms cover you. See, that's similar to what he was saying in Isaiah chapter 5. Here we have the grave opening up its great big ugly mouth, going to swallow them up. That's the second woe. The third woe, Isaiah 5, verses 18 and 19. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if with a cart rope, that say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. See, committing evil was like, for some of these people, was their chief purpose. I mean, that's what they wanted to do. Sin follows them like a cart. It talks about sin as if with a cart rope. He's got a cart behind him, and he's got a rope, and he's pulling it, and he just keeps putting more and more sin in it. He's enlarging it more and more. And so these individuals that the woe was pronounced upon, they are dragging their sins around with them. They're piling sin upon sin. And we know, and the Bible tells us, that one sin leads to another. And so they're pulling this heavy load behind them. You know, in Proverbs, again, the wise man, Proverbs chapter 5, describes it like this in verse 22. Proverbs 5, verse 22. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray. That's what sin, transgressions, iniquities do. See, but these people are also cynical. You know, they say, verse 19, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. See, they're being cynical. They're mocking God. You know, we read about at the end of 2 Peter chapter 3, people that do the same thing. They're mocking. Well, look at this world. It's continued just like it has since the beginning of the world. Remember what Peter says? But this they willfully forget. What they forget? What God did in the flood. So there's always been cynical people who mocked God, mocked God's word, mocked God's people. So these people pursued sin. And then the final one, verses 20 and 21, put these two together because they're so similar. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who were wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. See, these people reject truth, absolute truth. They reject it. They call sin by names that sound acceptable. Greedy is called thrifty. Arrogance is called self-esteem. And on the list could go. So they blur these distinctions, you know, about morality and ethics and what's right and wrong. They try and blur it. Our society's very good at that. You know, you hear people in government, in the sporting world, the entertainment world, education world, and what do? They call evil good and good evil. And I just received this past week from a professor at Mizzou. He's a professor of science education. They're inviting people from small and rural schools. So I was targeted because I'm small and rural. To come to this conference, to this week-long like seminar, and you know what the seminar is about? How do you promote and put LGBTQ ideas into science? That's what the whole thing's about. They even paid you to do it, almost $1,000. See what is happening in Isaiah's day? That's what's happening now. Calling good evil and evil good. That's what our world does. You know, people like us who believe in biblical morality, we're called intolerant or oppressive or whatever. People today simply reject absolute truth. And when they do that, they have no moral guidance. You know, everything is fine. Everything is okay, regardless of what you do. And these people trust in their own wisdom. Like those people talked about in Romans chapter 1. They reject God. What do? They worship the creature rather than the creator. They worship themselves. See, they're arrogant. They're right in their own eyes. They trust in their own wisdom. They put themselves above God. That's exactly what they are doing. So he ends this by saying, this is what's coming. This is what's coming. Beginning in verse 24. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom will ascend like dust. Because they've rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they will come with speed, swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep. Nor will the belt on their loins be loosed, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. Whose arrows are sharp, and all their bows bent. Their horses' hooves will seem like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They'll carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. In that day, they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. Judgment is on the way for God's people. It's on the way. Why? He says, because they've rejected God's law and despised his word. That's why judgment's on the way. And what's Jehovah going to do? It says, he's going to lift up a banner to the nations from afar and whistle to them. That's exactly what he did. God, first of all, said, okay, Assyria, you're going to come in against the 10 northern tribes. And, of course, shortly after Isaiah writes this, that's exactly what happens. So God called Assyria. It was God behind it. He whistled to them. He called to them. Okay, Assyria, it's time for you to come. And Assyria did that. Assyria, they would come with speed, swiftly. They wouldn't be weary or stumble. They wouldn't sleep. Their arrows would be sharp. They would have many, many horses. And of course, they came in and destroyed the 10 northern tribes. And essentially, there were no more 10 northern tribes. But then what did he do? Then he called Babylon, whistled to them later, you know, 150 years later, whatever. Said, okay, Babylon, now it's time for you to come against the two southern tribes and take them into captivity for 70 years. And that's, of course, exactly what they did. So God's people, they rejected the law of the Lord. They despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. You know, many of these people tried to justify their sin. calling good evil and evil good. I mean, that's why they did that, so they could, you know, justify their sin. And we have to be careful that our culture doesn't change our ideas of right and wrong. You know, if it's right, it's right. If it's wrong, regardless of what our culture and society says, regardless of what the Supreme Court says, regardless of what the president says. Doesn't make any difference what they say. The Bible, God's word, is our ultimate source of authority. I'm not going to be judged about what the Supreme Court decided. God's not going to bring that up on Judgment Day. He's not going to bring up what the president said or the Congress said was okay. It's going to be, what did I say in my word? That's my final judge. Those words, that's what's going to judge me. And that's why we can't let society, culture, anyone else influence our idea of right and wrong. What's good is good, what's evil is evil, regardless of what anybody else says. So that's our lesson this morning. You know, thinking about, you know, are we trying to justify sin? Are we letting our country or others in our country change our ideas of right and wrong? So this morning, if there's a need in your heart for the prayers of the congregation, we ask you to come as we stand and sing this song.